But the Bee Gees have a, there's a new documentary out about the Bee Gees coming up tomorrow night. We're talking about it because they were the victims of one of the most famously odd kind of circumstances that you could never have designed this to happen. For all the people that wanted disco to end, they never could have imagined it would have in the way that it did. And we'll talk about it with somebody who was there, along with our main guest, Harvey Kubernick. Docs That Rock, Music That Matters, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. We'll do open lines coming up next hour on Coast to Coast. Before we do, we'll let you join the conversation at the bottom of the hour. So in about 20 minutes from now, we'll give the numbers and you can jump in with Harvey Kubernick. We're talking about the book Docs That Rock, Music That Matters, but mostly we're just talking about the Bee Gees and this upcoming documentary that's being released tomorrow night on HBO, because it contains this very crucial period about the death of disco. Before we get to that, though, and a guy who was there for the event, Harvey, you know, it's hard to underestimate the impact of both then the main course album, which is fabulous. It's a very good album, and then a great pop album, and then the Saturday Night Fever soundtrack, which changes everything. I mean, it just to this day, it still sells. I mean, you would be, bands that came out with an album today would be lucky to get the annual sales that Saturday Night Fever soundtrack still gets.
You know, one of the reasons for the backlash, which is sort of the aftermath of this incident that happened at Comiskey Park in Chicago, Illinois, this disco demolition event, we all wore bell bottoms. We all wore some of that wardrobe, and so people bring that to the table as well. So you have that element, but I think with the Bee Gees, they became the face of disco far more than a lot of the pioneering artists or acts or producers. It was kind of a
that's engineering. True.
So there were other people making great disco. So, and remember, I was never in this death to disco thing. I spent many years happily not only going to discos, but if there was a disco artist on a record label, I was the only white guy that they would call and say, "Will you interview the Hughes Corporation? Will you interview Barry
right.
White? Will you come meet Donna Summers?" Are you kidding? The best catering, accessible people. I don't care if there were drum machines. They were trying to make a living and make music.
And they made great music. And I'm not taking anything away from Donna Summer. Obviously, you know, she was, I mean, she's her own kind of genius. I think here's the problem. Now, check me if I'm wrong on this. I think the problem was not so much with the Bee Gees. It was just the overexposure. It was just, I was a disc jockey during a lot of that period, and it was just every 70 minutes, just every, I mean, and it was not just the disco artists, which I had no problem with. The hard part was seeing some of my rock idols sell out to sell records.
Everybody wanted that. Everybody, remember, the dance floor
exactly
was equivalent to the end zone in football.
Right.
Everybody wanted to score. The other thing was the accessories, shall we say, attached to the disco genre. You know, in 1976, Billboard established a disco chart. And with that brings a disco body shaper stuff and the accessories.
Right.
That becomes of that. And that's not even talking. And also the media glamorized the incessant drum beats, some of the drug use, shall we say.
Oh, yeah, tons of it, right?
And also, you also had, and not because I have some degree in sociology and hail from San Diego State.
Aztecs.
You also have a situation where a culture was developed in clubs, underground clubs, Latino, Latina,
right.
Black, gay, developed there, that all of a sudden
right.
seeped into
Mainstream culture. Exactly.
And who really did the exploitation dance on top of it, which just drove a lot of people crazy. But the other thing that I think inherently on why disco drove a lot of people bonkers, including DJs that missed their rock and roll organic.
Me too.
And we're listening to machines.
Right.
I remember 40, 42 years ago, I was in a studio and I ran into some of the members of Toto, Steve Lukather in
right.
Toto, and they had just seen kind of a very early presentation of a drum machine. This could be like 72, 74, 75. Somebody brought in a drum machine to show the members of Toto's something that was going to be at the NAMM convention. And I said to young Steve Lukather, and he might have even been doing the Boz Scaggs album, Silk Degrees, and I said, you know, God, I kind of wanted to be a drummer. And Steve said, when they saw the demonstration, they all turned to each other and said, kill it before it multiplies.
Right, right.
Because I thought it would put people out of work. Of course, now when you listen to current music with auto-tune, rap, hip-hop, all kinds of music, it's not, there's no more real trumpets and horn players and
right.
bass people and arrangers. That stuff's being sampled and used. Why don't we get the backlash on that?
Here's why I think. And again, I think that's a really fair point. I also think, you know, it's the first ones that take the arrows in the chest,
yeah.
right? So the drum machine was just that whole synth sound wasn't very sophisticated yet either, and it was annoying, and it was the same thing on every record. But more than that, it was somebody who I loved, Rod Stewart, doing Do You Think I'm Sexy. It was, you know, Kiss doing a disco record, a band that I loved. It was the Rolling Stones. It was just like, oh, come on. And I tweeted this out earlier that I don't think that the disco demolition, the disco sucks, the end of disco movement, I don't think of it so much as some people will often talk about as being like a, you know, with tones of racism. There had always been soul music. There had always been dance music. That wasn't the problem. I thought we were killing disco in order to free the hostages. That's how I looked at it.
Well, I have to say, I threw in the disco towel. I mean, I've enjoyed watching the development of the bump and the hustle. I was in some super... Remember, I had danced on teen shows like American Bandstand. I'm very proud. But I have to admit, I really liked the people doing the robot. But once there was a dance called the Watergate, count me out.
Okay, we'll leave it there. So here's who I want to bring in. Harvey, I want you to meet my friend Dan Filato. He is an executive producer of radio shows with... and podcasts such as Artie Lang, and then when Artie Lang was doing a show with Nick DiPaolo, he also worked with Stephen A. And he was the producer for Steve and Gary in Chicago, although he wasn't yet the head producer for that show. He had just started to work there, but he was there that night.
You mean on the loop?
Yes, on the loop, and this is because Steve Dahl had moved over from WDAI, which had been a great station until they became Disco DAI, which did not help in Chicago.
No.
Dan Filato, are you there? Danny, we're bringing you up. Can you hear us?
Yes, I am.
Hey, Dan.
I could go through your long list of people that you worked with. We just don't have that much time. I should mention Harry Shearer as well. But you were there that night of Comiskey Park for Disco Demolition. You had been around in the early part of the conversations about this promotion. Describe for Harvey and for the rest of us, what was the behind the scenes building up to that night, July 12th, 1979, and this big radio promotion that was supposed to go off during the seventh inning stretch and then let the game finish?
Well, first off, I'm a Libra, if that makes a difference with you guys.
It doesn't. It doesn't at all. Not at all. You're not in the club.
I was an intern, and the White Sox had come to the radio station and said, hey, you know, these guys, Steve and Gary, are very popular. Why don't we do something with them? And specifically Mike Vec, Bill Vec's son. And there were some meetings, and Bill and Mike, mostly, and our sales guys got together and said, hey, why don't we do this? And they came up with an idea, which was to bring the disco records and get in for a reduced price. And then they pitched it to Steve, and then Steve came in on the meetings, Steve and Gary, and then, you know, at that time, the talk was 5,000 to 7,000 people will show up. And that, to Steve, was a nightmare, and he almost canceled it. And then, we started to build up, and we promoted it and promoted it and promoted it. And, you know, no one had any clue at all. In fact, even being there in the first game, it wasn't in the seventh inning stretchy. It was in between the two games.
Oh, that's what it was. Sorry.
It was a doubleheader, yeah.
It was a doubleheader. That's right. Sorry.
Point night doubleheader. And no one had any clue of what was going to happen in between those two games.
All right. Now, you were there then in the conversation. So, and Harvey, if you got a question, jump in. Again, we're talking with a guy who was there the night of Disco Demolition, Dan Filato. I don't remember it, and I was not there that night for the event, but I was in Chicago at the time. I don't remember there being this big racist element that somehow people keep talking about as a subtext for that night. Was that ever part of the conversation?
Never. Never once. And, you know, quite frankly, White Sox Stadium is on the south side of Chicago.
Right.
So, and, you know, why would we want to
alienate or incite or anything? Right.
But, you know, I do think there's one element, and the documentary shows this. I had hints of it. Yes, people brought records to blow up disco albums and all that, but I would say 2 to 5% of the albums bought were things like Superfly, Stevie Wonder, Songs in the Key of Life.
That's wrong.
Albums.
That's just wrong. Those are great albums.
Right. Yeah. Not all 2 to 5%, but these were rhythm and blues tablets that were kind of tossed in there too, and they certainly weren't disco albums.
I'm going to guess here and say there were probably a few guys who wanted to get in, and they took those albums from their sister's pile when she wasn't looking in order to get them to the gate. Right, Danny?
Yes, that's exactly right. Ian, you hit it out of the park with your analogy about it was in your face.
Right.
Radio stations were changing from rock stations to disco. We would have 2 and 3 disco stations in every city.
Right.
And for us, quite frankly, we didn't fit in the clothes, the disco clothes, me and my friends. And that is why we didn't like the music.
You didn't look good in Kiana?
No, I did not. I'm an Italian-American, and I sweat a lot, and polyester just doesn't hold up well.
That's funny. So, again, I think this is so that for people who don't know about it, what was the record? The number of people who showed up that night obviously blew the doors out, and also the parking lot too.
Right. There were about 45,000, 50,000 inside the park, and about 20,000 outside. And still, in the seventh and eighth inning of the first game, we had no clue. I was there. I brought my cousin with me, and my cousin had this terrible earache. So every, inning break, I'd have to take him to the bathroom and drop iodine in his ear.
We were
going back and forth and back and forth. It wasn't until then Steve and Gary went on the field, and I was on the field for about 2 minutes, and then my cousin was waving me, hey, we got to do the iodine thing again. My ear is hurting. So I took him to the bathroom to drop the iodine in his ear. And about 5 minutes later, when we came out and we were walking through underneath Comiskey Park, I'm looking at television. And I said to my cousin, Bobby, I said, listen, hey, they're showing the free beer night in Cleveland. Look at all those people on the field. I had no clue that that was a live camera. I knew they broke away in between the two games.
Right.
They didn't show this. And then we went back on the field, And then all of a sudden, all hell broke loose.
Yeah. Harvey, a question or a thought on that?
You know, it's interesting. It's a world, context is king. It's a world before MTV is really established. It's a world long before the internet. So this is in Illinois. This is in Chicago. But it made such a big impact.
Oh, yeah.
But what I noticed in research and talking to some of the writers over the decades, the writers secretly and even overtly liked this event. They were happy this happened. It was almost biblical.
Yep.
That they could join in, and even though there could have been chaos and liability and some real craziness that happened, everybody wanted a change. This is...
That's a good point.
This is a year before John Lennon. The 80s are coming to us. Everybody wanted a return to organic stuff. But still, the concept of bringing albums to destroy, I never could grasp that. I knew it was a publicity promotional stunt gone a little awry, and it certainly must have got the station ratings and all kinds of stuff. But
yeah.
But still, there was some symbolism of a genre, we'll call it.
Oh, yeah.
Really stopping in its tracks. Although to this day, if you go see the Rolling Stones, Miss You gets the most applause on the meter.
Right.
Rod Stewart is trapped doing Do You Think I'm Sexy? So you see the ramifications of involvement 40 years later. Disco, some of these same people who were 20 are now 60. They're paying money to see some of their people do things that have disco tracking.
Yeah, no, that's true. And there was, just to make the point about Chicago, I'm not saying that Chicago, like any northern city, didn't have its racial issues, but generally around the music, that wasn't it. And in Chicago, WLS, WCFL, these stations were legends, and they were these giant sticks because it was a very classic top 40 format with a lot of R&B. Nobody had any, I don't know, Danny, nobody had any animosity towards Stevie Wonder. And
no.
Everybody thought Superfly was pretty fly. So, I mean, it's like that part, it's interesting that those albums got thrown into the mix, but I don't think it was emblematic of the movement. I think your point, though, Harvey, and Disco Demolition, and again, we're talking about kind of the end of things for the disco era and for the Bee Gees in a lot of ways, is that night in July of 1979, I think it was very cathartic. And I think that catharsis maybe just let out a lot more than people thought was there. And I think that may have been the most surprising thing, was that suddenly people were really nationally reveling in a rebellion against a format which seemed kind of synthetic and had been overdone. But some people would argue, Harvey, and I want to ask you about this. Dan, can you hang on after the break and we'll get you in there? Because I want you to tell Harvey the story quickly, if you can, about meeting Barry Gibb years later. But I think that catharsis, it speaks to the fact that disco was already dying. The Bee Gees may have extended its life, and this was that way of saying, okay, really, now let's shift into the 80s. And that's really what happened. But the Docs That Rock, Music That Matters, we'll talk more with Harvey Kubernick and my friend Dan Filato, who was there that night at Comiskey Park for Disco Demolition, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. You got like, I think the big difference of hearing a lot of Bee Gees retrospectively is that you don't hear it every 20 minutes. And it brings back the fun and the value of it. And it really was, very good music. It was just overdone so much. And so that famous night where people stood up and said no to no more disco at Comiskey Park, it's a night worth knowing about. If you don't, we'll talk more about it in just a second. But it was also a very painful night for the Bee Gees. And our two guests will go back to that conversation as we start to bring you into it next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. We'll do open lines starting in about like 20 minutes or so on Coast to Coast AM. But before we do, we'll grab a couple of calls for Harvey Kubernick. Docs That Rock, Music That Matters. Dan Filato, an old friend of mine, has agreed to come on for just a few more minutes and talk about the time that he met Barry Gibb. But let me ask Harvey before you do, Danny. So did you ever talk to Barry about that night, the disco demolition night, Harvey?
No, I haven't, but I have to say that night, the Bee Gees were not in pain. They were headlining a Coliseum show, I think, in Oakland. So the involvement of let's just say the results of certainly a diminished airplay for a long time after, but still, they could have number one records in Japan, go to Jakarta.
Of course.
It kept going. And while nobody really realizes, their catalog was still being covered by people. So there was income from songwriting. So their career really wasn't, it was stalled as far as radio and that visibility. But, you know, sometimes out of chaos, great things happen. I remember running into Quincy Troupe at MCA Records. I'm sorry, Quincy Jones at MCA Records when he was working on The Wiz, and we were both lamenting we were having some tough times at the label. And he said, "But man, I met Michael Jackson on the set." And what happened with the Bee Gees? All of a sudden, their airplay dries up, but Barry starts writing more songs or becomes a producer
right.
for all these headline acts. So look what comes out of that.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Dan told me a story the other day about running into, what restaurant were you in L.A., Dan?
We were at Shotzi.
Okay.
Arnold Schwarzenegger's restaurant.
All right. So hanging with your friend Harry Shearer, who shared management with Barry Gibb, and he's like, "Yeah, he's a great guy. He's not going to mind meeting you at all." And so you see Barry Gibb across the room at the restaurant, and you come up and talk to him, and minus the profanity, tell Harvey what happened.
Well, you know, I went up, I asked Harry, I said, "Hey, listen, you know, we're doing a 25th anniversary of Disco Demolition. There's Barry Gibb. What do you think?" And he said, "He is the nicest guy in the world. We have the same management. I will go over and introduce you. I am sure." He goes, "In fact, this has come up that I have told him that I know you. But I'll introduce you, and you can ask him. And I'm sure he'll do it." And Harry is never wrong on some of these things.
Right.
And
never wrong on some of these things. 70% of the time, it works every time.
Exactly.
Right.
So I walked over, and Harry introduced me, and I said, "You know, it's an honor, and we're doing a 25th anniversary. PBS was doing a 25th anniversary of Disco Demolition. Would you like to be on?" And his face went ashen. It looked like Lee Harvey Oswald when he was shot by Jack Ruby. That's how pained he was. And at first, Harry and I thought he was joking. And then he sat down and he started to eat his meal again. And Harry thought he was joking. So Harry goes, "So, Barry, do you want to do it?" And I said, "Yeah, we'd love to have you. We'd have total respect." And he just turned and looked at me and said, "Why would I want to do a show that ruined our lives? You people ruined our lives." And then I knew that he was totally serious, and we walked away. I said, "I'm so sorry for bothering you. You know, enjoy your meal."
Yeah, you check your watch, do a Rob Petrie, walk away. All right. I love that story. Dan, thank you so much, and thanks for giving us the background on that night in Comiskey Park. Good stories.
Absolutely. Thank you, Dan.
We'll bring in some other callers as well. Again, we're talking with Harvey Kubernick, and then we'll do open lines. But and as you said even earlier, Barry Gibb, well-known, super nice guy, but obviously still has a you know, it's still harboring at least at the time a little bit of animosity about that night. Yeah. All right. So let's get to some phones on Coast to Coast AM, and then someday Harvey, I think we're going to have to call have you back because you get so many of these cool stories, and I know we're just deep
lying and scratching the surface.
Yeah. Linda Marie is in Medford, west of the Rockies on Coast to Coast AM. Linda?
Good evening, Ian. Good evening, Harvey.
Hello, Linda.
Hello. I want to ask you, it's a bit of trivia that I know, but first I want to ask you if you know first, is do you know how Mr. and Mrs. Gibb met?
Well, there's three. Well, she was a beauty queen. You mean Barry Gibb's wife? Is that what we're talking about?
Uh-huh, yes.
She was.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Their parents. The brother's parents.
Oh, no. Absolutely. I mean, I'm sure in Australia.
Actually, no. They met in Manchester, England.
Manchester, England, and then they moved to Australia. No, I do know that. Was she maybe a singer?
I think so, but I'm not sure about that. But what I do know is, I listen to a podcast that Peter Noone does every week on SiriusXM. And he told a story about how Mr. Noone and Mr. Gibb were on a double date with two girls. And they actually hit it off with each other and paired off, and they become the Noones and the Gibbses.
And look how we all benefit from that.
Yeah. And the Bee Gees are such wonderful singers because they had a long voyage between England and Australia, as you can imagine.
Now, that must have been
your question is?
Well, that must have been a second wife, though, right? Because Peter Noone would have been dating, because he was like, what?
No, he wasn't born yet. I'm talking about
about the original.
Oh, the original. Okay. All right, fine. Got it. Senior. Got it. Okay. All right. And then you had a follow-up comment?
No, that was okay. All except that I've always loved the Bee Gees music, and I'm perusing your other books and looking forward to reading.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
You're going to enjoy our bumpers for the rest of the night, too. Let's go to Michael in Louisiana on Coast to Coast AM. Michael?
Hey, can you hear me?
Perfectly.
Hi, Michael.
Hey, how y'all doing? You know, I think I'll date myself, but during the 70s, I saw the greatest, Zeppelin, Floyd, and The Who. But when 79 hit, it was like the downfall and the death of rock and roll.
In 79? Why?
Yeah, it's 79. And I remember reading a story in Rolling Stone, early 80s, and Billy Joel was asked, you know, what do you think the state of rock and roll is? And he said, when John Bonham died, that's it.
Oh,
done.
Interesting.
And in the disco era, at that time, when it came out, you know, 77, 78, it also, the Sex Pistols came out in 76, and that it destroyed everything.
Well, let's unpack that a little bit, and thanks for the comment, Michael, because the Sex Pistols were, and punk was already big in England in the earlier part of the decade. I mean, that was already a happening thing. It was coming over, it was filtering over. The Ramones were obviously, I mean, there was obviously some punk, there was obviously this sort of new garage band, a punk ethic that was growing in rock. But disco didn't start in 1977. Disco, too, had been huge in Europe for years. It wasn't.
It goes back to the 50s and the 60s,
yeah.
And really flourishes when the 70s start.
Exactly. And what do you think of as the first disco record? I have to ask you this question because I heard a proposal on. I just think of it as I think of, I mean, the first solid, pure disco record. What would you say it was?
Wow. Well, I'll tell you, just for me, when I was at the launch party of Casablanca Records for Donna Summer,
right,
and they played the extended, unedited version of Love to Love You Baby,
believe me,
I know there were things before that. But here I am at this launch party. Robert Wagner's there with Natalie Wood. What beautiful eyes she had. Donna Summer walks in, and we're in Beverly Hills, and I hear this 18-minute, but I realized.
Do you mean I Feel Love, not Love to Love You Baby?
Love to Love You Baby, the first thing. And I just said, this is different. This is something, maybe because it was long and I knew that the producer engineer had something to do with it, but there'd always been dance. Listen, even in the early 70s, people like Emperor Roscoe in England had mobile disco equipment at stadium concerts, you know, of rock, playing rock and roll. And Stax and R&B and Motown music. And believe me, there was kind of disco music coming in the reggae world where there was dub and loop stuff that was danceable. But, you know, we put our brains together and we went back even earlier, there was probably some great underground of things that were played, you know, in discos long before Studio 54 opened that we've missed. But I kind of think that Donna Summer changed that game, gave it kind of a big face.
I would say, and I think this is the argument that I heard, and I have to say, every time I hear it, it reaffirms to me, was Papa Was a Rolling Stone. The 7-minute version of Papa Was a Rolling Stone.
That's so astute of you, because I ran into Norman Whitfield with Russ Regan one night at a Whole Foods in Sherman Oaks, California. I was introduced to him, who produced that record for Motown. Right. And Harvey meet Norman Whitfield, and I said, you know, Papa Was a Rolling Stone. And he said, yeah, man, that was good floor music. And I said, what do you mean floor music? And he said, well, you know, I was listening to underground progressive FM radio, white people music a lot at the time. And he was putting in wah-wah pedal stuff.
Right.
And he called it floor music. Now, I know he meant dance floor music. So that's a very good point you're making. And that was the whole new direction for the Temptations, much like the Bee Gees having a whole new trip when they went into the disco world for a while.
And I think it's the strings over the thumping drum and bass.
And also one thing about the Bee Gees, let's always remember from 1975 to 79, their keyboardist was Blue Weaver, who had been in the Straubs. You had real keyboard stuff. Also on stage, you had horns and trumpets with a backing band. They were a band. They had a band in that 75 to 79 period. Sure, the three people were the principals. But you had a band taking it into stadiums.
Yeah. Don is in Englewood, Ohio on Coast to Coast in the time we have left for Harvey Kubernick. Docs That Rock, Music That Matters. Don?
Thanks so much, both you guys. First, Ian, you got the best show on the planet. Second, your guests are 5-6-star. I have a couple things.
Sure.
Thank you, Don.
In Japan, when I came back from Vietnam, we stopped in Japan and went to the O Club. Guess the Commodores were at the O Club with Lionel Richie in Japan. They were on a world tour, and they were absolutely great because disco was hitting in early 75. In Japan, anyway. I have a question for him, though. Really, it's not been on my mind. Do you ever remember Roy Buchanan?
I saw him play at the Roxy. I know a guitarist. I know the influence Roy Buchanan. He's an unsung guitar hero to the masses, but to people who play guitar, he was a guy, you know, from like Canada. He was a guy. He cut records for Polydor Records. I remember. Fantastic guitar player.
The scuttlebutt was that Roy Buchanan turned down Rolling Stone. The Rolling Stones.
I don't think it went that far. There were 5 or 6 or 7 candidates, but he was into his own groove.
Oh, he was definitely. What else? I saw the B-52s in Ocean Beach with about 30 people in there. It was great.
By the way, I did the first United States interview with the Commodores the date when they came back from Japan after you saw them. And Lionel Richie was fantastic.
Yeah.
Wasn't he so genuine?
Yeah. I interviewed him once, too, and I have to say, it really one of my fondest memories during that period when I was interviewing a lot of rock stars on the radio. I thought Lionel Richie was just amazing.
Just beautiful guy. And I said, who is your favorite group? And he said, I saw Cream in Alabama. I said, really? And then 30 years later, I ran into him, and I said, are you still digging Cream? And he said, young man, I just had dinner last night with Eric Clapton.
And I totally believe him, too. That's really cool. Well, thank you. Appreciate that. Let me get to Theodore, who's in Baltimore on Coast to Coast AM. Running out of time, Theodore, if you can keep the question short, be great.
Yeah, I think your historical revisionism is a bit off.
I don't know what you're talking about. Nobody's revising history here, but what is your comment?
This disco music started with black people. And
that's what we said.
Scene that you had in that stadium, they didn't just make a mistake and, as you say, pick those records off of their sister's dresser. They were just doing that. It was a deliberate thing. Because it appears that, you know, when you talk about the history of these things, you downplay the racial aspect. I know why.
Well, No. This is not fair. You can't read my mind. You don't know why. And I'm not
down to the table.
Yeah, but I'm not downplaying anything. I was in Chicago. You weren't. And I'm telling you that that was not what was being said. It was not. There were plenty of white people in the disco clubs. That was not a problem. So you can make it out to be one, but it wasn't. In fact, you know, these clubs on the near north side, that was a heavily mixed crowd and everybody was happy. It was not about that. It was really anger toward some of the white acts and a lot of the animosity that they had given up on rock. So I appreciate your perspective, but it's not revisionism, and I think instead what's happened is this racial component has gotten injected into it, and I'm not saying that it couldn't be true for 1% or 2%. I have no idea, but it was not what was driving that night at all, and especially not on the south side of Chicago, not certainly with the Chicago White Sox, because that was not their vibe at all. That was not what it was about. But we do have time for one more person, and let's see if we got time. Richard is in Victoria on Coast to Coast AM. Richard?
Very quickly, you mentioned the early Bee Gees group, which was Vince Mulooney on guitar,
right,
and Colin Peterson on drums.
Yes.
Vince actually had the one and only lead vocal that wasn't sung by a Gibb. It was on a song called Such a Shame from the Idea album, although it got lifted from that album and replaced with Gotta Get a
Message to You
when it was released in North America.
Which is a great song and a good call.
Band, but he is alive and Colin is alive.
Oh, that's cool. Well, that's wonderful. Harvey, I hope you had fun.
Had a blast.
Good. Love having you out there listening to Coast, and we'll have to have you back. I will look forward to your reflections at a later date on that Bee Gees doc when it runs tomorrow night, and further conversations, no doubt, along the way. Thanks for being such a great guest and handling these calls so perfectly. And that's just where we'll return to it coming up in just a minute. Your calls, we'll give you the numbers. You can pick it up from here. You can continue the conversation, or you can start a whole new one. That's what open lines are all about on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.